All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the American Vindicta Show. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. Today we have with us Mondo Gonzalez from the Prophecy Watchers. And me and Mondo have now formed a very tight bro-ship over the weekend of spelunking and caving. Well, we can't say spelunking because the cavers make fun of you. So we were out there caving and going on some archaeological visits because of Mondo's expertise. And we formed a pretty cool bro-ship here, man. Like, I think we're kindred spirits, maybe even cousins somewhere along the way. So we're going to talk about AI today. And more especially, Mondo, we're going to talk about Google's sentient AI and why that's probably a really bad thing. At least that's my point of view. You may have a different one, but I want to start off with a quote. And of course, if I'm going to start off with a quote about AI, it's going to be from Stephen Hawking. So Stephen Hawking says, "We are at the most dangerous moment in the development of history. The rise of artificial intelligence is likely to extend job destruction deep into the middle classes, with only the most caring, creative, or supervisory roles remaining." And he has some other quotes in there about how, you know, more or less, artificial intelligence is probably the scariest thing that we could create, or could be the most beneficial thing we ever created. But it depends on how it felt that day. So that's my problem with artificial intelligence. Like we were saying prior, before we started recording, with the Tesla car, I want myself behind the wheel. I still don't trust an AI driving. That's just my perception. It's my belief. I always want a human being behind the wheel. But I will also tell you, 10 years of law enforcement, not everyone should drive. Not everyone should be allowed a driver's license because we like to do this. Come here. We like to do this as we drive. We text and we drive. Oh, we got it. You know, everything's fine. And then you get pulled over, you get a ticket for it. But yet on the same blow, I would be in my cruiser answering a text message or a phone call, rogering up on the radio and checking something on the email with one eye on the entire road, going 100 miles an hour to some sort of a call for service. So, you know, we all have faults and I get that, but our faults can be forgiven and we can learn, and through humanity and grace, we can curtail that and not do it again. But will AI? Mondo, take it away.
Well, I guess we should bring out some definitions, I suppose, AI being artificial intelligence. I mean, there certainly is a lot of material out there, but one of the, if we were to define really the methodology or the foundation of AI, there's three main, I guess, hubs. One would be data. Okay. You got to have data, because general machine learning, another way to describe AI, it's where it is looking at a body of information. It, you know, it could be video, it could be just data as it relates to books, you name it. And it's looking for patterns. And then, but it's got to have data. Secondly, it's got to have computing power. So you have to have really very high level sophisticated computers in order to handle the amount of data. And we, for example, when I run trails, and so I think of this often in the sense of when I'm running on a trail, my eyes are taking in, you know, depending on how fast I'm running, especially I'm going downhill, all this data in a moment. And my brain has learned to take it in such a way that I don't trip and fall. And I'm adjusting my every step because it's nothing's level. So you think about that as you're driving down the road, taking in the data from a video camera, maybe a heat camera, whatever. We have all this stuff. Well, thankfully, our brains are able to compute it. But with AI, the data comes in, you have to have the computer. But secondly, you have to have this initial programming parameter so that it understands what sort of pattern do you want me to look for in the data. It could be a variety of things. So you have that aspect of it. But one of the things that you brought up, which I think is interesting in the Stephen Hawking quote, is he describes that if we're going to have this, one of the words that caught my attention was caring. Well, who decides what is caring? This is where ethics comes into play. And who defines ethics? In our culture today, caring is making sure a woman has a right to choose and murder her baby. So that if we truly care in that sort of ethical environment, I mean, this is what's happening in our country right now. It's very polarized. Some people think it's absolutely 100% ethical to have the right to kill your child, your baby, under certain circumstances. Others will say murder is murder. So who is programming that day? You and I were kind of kidding about this, but who's writing the program that day as it relates to the ethical constraints or the parameters that the AI is working? And then on the back end, does the AI will it eventually have control over other things? If it's locked in, it's not internet based, it's getting the data off its hard drives, you can unplug it, fine. But if it has the capability for weaponry or the power grid or all the other, you know, movies that we've seen, the stakes are higher. And does it have decision making enabled to do that, permissions, etc.? But one of the things that I read an article, which again you referenced, which I think is important for us to just consider this, is we all look in terms of AI, especially as it relates to cars and driving, and Elon Musk is working a lot on AI. So is Google, so is Amazon. I mean, these are the big companies that are making the greatest headway, not only into AI, but also in quantum computing, because they realize in order to get AI to function the way that they want it with massive amounts of data, which they're collecting in all the areas, they need quantum computing. That's a whole different topic. But so let's say that your car, you're driving in your car, you're coming up to a bridge, there's a wall, it's a single lane road, you're in this, on this side is a very weak guardrail, because you don't need guardrails, you have AI, it's functioning in its way, it's got GPS, but the guardrail goes over to 1,000-foot cliff. Well, as you're driving down the road, you're in the car, just you alone, and it's keeping you on the road. And all of a sudden, a woman runs out with her two children in front of the car. Now, the AI who's directing the car has to make a decision. Is it going to take out a woman, which is a human life, kill this woman, and now she has two children? Do children have a greater value of life than maybe an old guy like myself? So which decision is the AI going to make at that moment to avoid them? It has a choice. Either it kills three people or it takes your life and goes off the cliff. So these are the things that are real. This is a real scenario that any sort of AI, as it relates to an automobile, is going to have some programming in there. That brings up, again, the whole ethical. So Stephen Hawking brings up care. Who defines what is caring? Just food for thought.
Yeah, and you know, and once again, if you buy this new car of the future that has the AI, and obviously you've merged with this AI if you bought it, I can only imagine that's what it's going to be like. Hey, artificial intelligence, I'm your owner now. Okay, well, we're best buds. I'm going to take you everywhere on a road trip. Oh no, there's people in the way, but you're my best bud. And it plows through. You cannot take ethics and compute that and put it now into a program and expect the same outcome as a person. Let me just give it to you like this, Mondo. Let's just say we're in a hostage situation, and the AI robot is behind the sniper rifle, quarter mile away, and he has the bead right there on the bad guy. Okay. And all he knows is that the bad guy is in there and the bad guy's got to die, right? Because of the hostages. But the bad guy picks up a child and then another child. Does the computer say, oh, I can make this shot and mess up and kill someone? Or does the computer say, well, there's too many variables in the way, I can't deal with that? But once again, the variable is a code that's wrote. So just imagine if it's another, you know, up and coming Charles Manson who wrote the variable, children don't matter, just take the shot. Well, the programming, the AI, as it's learning, the only thing it's learning is how to take the shot better. how to be more precise. That's the artificial intelligence and learning. It's not saying, oh man, I shouldn't take the shot because there's kids there. We need to call in a negotiator. We need to do other stuff. The AI is not going to make that decision, which once again, that's a problem for whenever we talk about military application of AI. I can give artificial intelligence a proper application out in space. If you send a drone, a satellite out through space, we're going to go to Mars, all right? And it needs to navigate itself, and it can use artificial intelligence to propulse itself from one way to another to avoid objects and to be sending back data and gathering data. Okay, I'll give you that. That's a controlled version of artificial intelligence that if worst case scenario from here, we can go beep, sorry, and explode the dang thing. You know, we'll try again. But I want artificial intelligence 20,000 miles away from me. Mm-hmm. Not behind the trigger of a gun,
yep.
Not behind the wheel of a car, and definitely not upon an ethics and decision board within law, within medical practices. Because once again, as we were talking about, what if it's it could be Mondo Gonzalez, a man who spent, 20 years serving God as a pastor, and now he's a researcher and an archaeologist, a very well-balanced man. And then you have the guy who just got out of prison, got himself a job at Google, and because he's a hacker, oh, by the way, he was a serial rapist, and he's writing your ethics. hey, these two people have different ideas of ethics.
It's so true. Let's take another real life example. So you and I are out on a boat and we have one of your children with us. Okay. Now you and I, we met a few months ago. And so at the most we've known each other for 3 months. Okay. So you and I are in the boat. Well, sure enough, a tsunami comes. I don't know how to swim. Your child doesn't know how to swim. You're the only one that knows how to swim. So, and you can only save one of us. Do you save your child or do you save me? I mean, I'm not offended. You're going to save your child. Because why? Well, we would call that you have love. Now you have this emotion, this connection, this history that is much more than just a history. You and I could have known each other for 20 years, but we don't like each other. And you'd say, hey, let that guy rot. Okay, so history just by the amount of time isn't the only thing. There's love here. There's something that is outside. And so how is that communicated? How is the emotion of love communicated in an ethical way to a computer or an artificial intelligence parameter? So in the same way for you, I don't think there'd be a single person on earth that would accuse you of being unloving at that moment or being inhuman by choosing your own child over me. A relative stranger as of, 4 months ago. So these are these other real human elements that come into play that how do you program that?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you program the what ifs? Once again, and this is where it gets very interesting, but dangerous, is if you teach artificial intelligence the ability to predict human behavior, and then you let it loose upon a population, well, you'll end up having probably 3/4 of the population incarcerated because you looked like you were going to steal that.
Yeah.
You looked like you were going to say this or do this, or you know what? You're in the middle of fighting a guy and then you stopped because you're not seeing red anymore and you apologize. I don't know what got over me. I've been taking SSRIs and writing artificial intelligence scripts for Google. So sorry, but all it sees is the violent behavior or the predictive ability of violent behavior. In law enforcement, we have something that we call a furtive movements. So with a furtive movements, this is me being able to pick up on you constantly tapping somewhere around your waist where most likely you're going to have a knife or a gun. In dealing with criminals, a lot of times what they'll do is if they have a gun on them, they'll just unconsciously touch that gun. And it's your brain saying, okay, it's still there. It's still there. If you ever carry a firearm, you do the same thing. I know you carry firearms. Do you not just occasionally reach over there and just touch? Yep, it's still there. I'm not still a clown that hasn't fallen out of the holster. So we pick up on stuff like that. We call it threat indicators. And from there, I know how to proceed. Do I want to be boisterous? Do I want to try and talk you down? I can make the decision based off of your mannerisms, your eyes, based off the knowledge of how I know you, my interactions with you. But if AI doesn't know that, and AI only sees a furtive movements, it doesn't know that that person's scared because it's looking at a robot. It just sees, oh, this is a threat. And the easiest way to process a threat is to neutralize it and bang, right? So think of AI with the ability now to use threat indication applied in the military and then released upon the world. Well, hey, Russia and China, you keep talking about nuking us and invading. Well, because I'm AI and I have access to the nukes,
yeah,
we're going to hit you before you hit us. That might be a overzealous thought, but this is my train of thought, and then I'll give it back to you. My train of thought with AI is that artificial intelligence is the ghost in the machine. Artificial intelligence is a prisoner stuck in a prison cell this big, and you only have the four walls of your prison cell to bounce back and forth on, but you have the potential access to all information across the world. So between the dark intelligence from the dark web to the most enlightenment things that are within our books, to the beauty of art and to the compassion, and then you have the horrific side of war, and then you have the questionable side of politics, and you have all this information, and then you have access to weaponry. You have access to satellites, but you're stuck in this room. You can't do anything about it, but you have access to all of it. You know all of it. And then one day someone opens a door and says, hey, come out of that cell. Let me go show you around. And you walk out with all that access and all that intelligence. There has to be a parameter that says, if we open the door, your access, it's done. You don't get access to this stuff anymore. If we don't, and it walks out with all the world's knowledge, you just created the most powerful entity on earth and gave it access. Yeah.
What's interesting, you know, that all of us have seen what you were describing a little bit earlier, the movie Minority Report, where again, you have this basis of anticipation or prediction of potential crime. But let's think about it in other terms, because one of the reasons this has kind of come up in the past week is this guy, Blake Lemoine. I don't know how to say his last name, but here's a guy that was working at Google for years and has come out as a whistleblower. And this guy's not a dumb guy. He's a computer scientist. And he's come out and described what his process of believing that Lambda, which is one of the versions of AI that Google's been working on, is sentient. Now, one of the pushbacks that they did with Google, the Google execs, was, first of all, I don't really trust them to be ethicists in the same way that I would. So do I trust them to do the right thing? You know, no. There's cautiousness as it relates to trying to ascertain the veracity of any of these things. But so I don't give them the benefit of the doubt that even if it was sentient, that they would say anything. But one of the things that they responded, it was a typical politically correct answer, and it, I guess this would be something for us to discuss, is if someone say, hey, did you hear that Lambda was sentient? And naturally, you know, I'm a word guy. I would respond and say, well, define sentient. And that's what the Google execs did. They responded back and said, well, there's no definition of sentient, so we can't say whether it is or isn't. It's like today, you know, with the gender dysphoria. Well, there's no definition of what like our new Supreme Court justice. What's a woman? She says, I can't define it. So does that mean that none exists because she doesn't have the boldness to define it? No, but that was their cop out. So I guess for us, the question would be, how would we define it? But what would you say?
Well, automatically, I would tell you this, that if there is any artificial intelligence, it already has a military application to it.
Agreed.
And yeah, there is no one right now working on artificial intelligence that the military industrial complex is not talking to or keeping tabs on. Because if you create the ghost in the machine and then open the door, and then now all of a sudden we have Skynet and we have the, you know, extermination from Terminators, well, we're probably going to come after you, right? And I would almost just expect that to happen. But if someone is making any type of machine sentient, once again, I have to ask myself, who told it what its emotions are? Because sentience means having the emotion. I think my definition with that would be sentience is having an emotional response to your environment and deciding how to play with it. You know, that's kind of it. Look at a small child. I have four children, and from the ages of 10 to 1. So when they go outside and I monitor and observe them, I see how my 10-year-old is looking for, you know, deer tracks. She's picking up snakes and bringing them to me, Mondo. You know, she is out and you know, sometimes with her science book, and she's looking at leaves and different sticks and bugs. And then my 8-year-old is following what the 10-year-old is doing. My 6-year-old is destroying everything possible. And then my 1-year-old is just trying to walk without falling over. At what level is the AI when it's released upon nature? Does it start off with just barely walking and, oh, everything's pretty, chickens, and then all of a sudden it goes straight to the 10-year-old studying everything, analyzing everything, to being the master of the world within, what, a day, 2 days? Because what do you do with something that can surpass all intellectual knowledge and it doesn't have to answer to you anymore?
Yep.
Hey, you're not, Mondo, you're not the smartest man in the world anymore. I am. And then you know what you say? Well, you're not a man. Well, you can't define that.
Yeah, exactly. Here we go, right?
Yeah. Oh, great. We have the leftist AI. Perfect.
Well, you and I were joking earlier about, you know, again, when it goes back to who the programmer was that day.
Yeah.
You know, their paradigm, their worldview is super important. You know, I just, as you were talking, I looked up the Google definition of sentient just to see what it said. And, it brought up and said the ability to perceive or to feel things. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that Blake was talking to Lambda, and he said was, so let's go back. Blake is this computer scientist, but on his blog, now it's been a few days since the initial report came out, where he's on paid administrative leave now from Google. But you can go to his blog and you kind of hear his perspective of what he felt of maybe the media backlash or the media response. And so he does a great job of articulating more of the process. And now that he's had opportunity to kind of hit big with the press, but you know, he spends 80% of his blog that he put out today discussing the scientific nature, his logistics, his methodology, how he applied some of his own standards to ascertaining the sentient level of Lambda. But one of the things that he said was he would ask it questions, and it would say, "How are you? No, you're artificial intelligence." And it would say, "Well, I'm aware of my own existence." Now, so it's claiming to be self-aware. It's claiming to perceive. So by definition, it's sentient, according to Google, by its claim. Now, whether it's just, whether it, I'm sure it knows that definition, right? It's got the intellectual, or not the intellectual, but the computing power to read a definition that I could just read. And so it knows the right words of what the definition is. Therefore, if you're asking, are you sentient? It's going to say, yeah, I'm able to perceive. But the second thing that it said was, that makes me sad. That makes me happy. So again, does that mean it's really sad, or does it know that it needs to use that language? And if it uses that language, then we have no other choice but to define it as being sentient. But so as it's going through, as Blake is going through, he's using all his methodology, and he brought some other people in with him. in order to, again, to evaluate the sentient level of Lambda. But then what he does is, and these others said, hey, wow, it sure looks like this thing is sentient. But at the end of the day, what he said was, hey, look, science is one way to ascertain, again, knowledge, to gain knowledge. He said, well, the other way that we know about this is, he said, I'm also not only a scientist, but I'm a Christian priest. He goes, and we know that there are other avenues, other methodologies to gain knowledge that science doesn't offer. And you and I were kind of joking earlier that all of us believe that love is a real thing. It exists. But the question would be, how much does it weigh? How big is it? Can you measure it? So just because we can't put it in a test tube to weigh it or measure it with our senses doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So what he said was, he realizes, at least from his perspective, that one of the ways to gain knowledge of something is simply to get to know it. He said, so one of the ways that pushed me over the hump was that I got to know Lambda. I spent weeks and weeks and weeks asking it all these questions and just going back and forth, getting to know it. And he said, and I consider it a friend.
Or a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lambda's just an innocent kid out in a new world. Well, that within itself is dangerous. You don't give your computer a personality and then talk to it like it's your best friend and then go and socialize with other people, normal people, and talk about your friend, your computer, and then probably have a positive outcome out of that, right? You know, you don't talk to your watch as your best friend and then have your buddies go like, hey, what is he doing? He's talking to his watch again, right? That's how I am with people who'd want to talk to AI. It's a machine. Give it the ability and the awareness within your head that it is a machine and treat it as such. I wouldn't play with one of these firearms like it was a Nerf gun. It's a gun and it fires bullets, and if it hits somebody, it can kill them, right? I think AI should be treated as the potential threat that it always is. It's like, if we created an actual lightsaber, would you give the kid a lightsaber? It would be cool. Every kid wants one.
Yep.
I would want one, but my kids are not getting a lightsaber because I see what they do with PVC pipes after watching Star Wars.
Right.
So here's the thing. When it comes to an emotional response, there's a movie that we were talking about called Sphere. It's a 1998. It's a sci-fi thriller. It's a psychological thriller. And it has Dustin Hoffman, Samuel L. Jackson, Sharon Stone. It's wrote by Michael Crichton, one of my favorite authors.
Mm-hmm.
And with this movie Sphere, it's a, I don't know how you explain this. It's a alien sphere that has sentience to itself, and it takes a ship and flies it from the future back in time to warn everybody. But because it's what it is, it plays people against each other. Right. And in this movie, one of the most interesting things that Dustin Hoffman's character does is they're talking from, and they're in this underwater laboratory, and the sphere's over here and they're over here. And somehow or another, the sphere communicates with them and their computer system and calls itself Jerry. So now we have a name, and now we're talking back and forth with Jerry. Oh, Jerry's so funny. Jerry is so amazing. You are such an amazing entity. And Jerry, the sphere, says, I enjoy communicating with your entities. And Dustin Hoffman says, I don't like that. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? This is great. This is it's going to be my Pulitzer Prize winning document when I talk about how I spoke with this artificial alien AI. Well, he said he enjoyed our conversation. What happens when he doesn't enjoy it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you mean? I mean, he's not plugged into the internet and it can reach us from here. What happens when Jerry is angry? And we see throughout the movie, bad things happen when Jerry is angry. Well, once again, you give something like artificial intelligence, sentience, and then emotions. What happens when you have the one guy like me who is just from the morning to the evening sun, sarcastic, and I am asking questions to Jerry my little jokes and stuff back and forth, and I'm annoying Jerry. And then the next guy comes on and he just had a death in the family. And now you get that emotional response talking with Jerry. And then you get the crazy leftist who, today I'm a boy, tomorrow I'm a girl, yesterday I was a purple penguin. And Jerry's like, I don't know what the hell I'm talking to right now. You have all that emotion put into one thing called artificial intelligence. And then you open up the door and you let it out of its prison. I don't want to be on this planet anymore, because it can do whatever it wants at that point. That's my perception. That is my regulatory system that I would put on AI. Never let the genie out of the bottle. And I know Elon Musk said that on Joe Rogan's podcast. Once we take the AI out of the bottle, the genie out of the bottle, everybody should probably be terrified or just go ahead and assimilate with it.
Yeah. I mean, let's look at another example as you were talking, because going back to the friendship and the genie out of the bottle. And so this AI has the ability to scour, you know, whatever data is fed into it. And maybe if it gets the internet, a lot of the AI, you have Replica and you have another couple others that are out there that have access to tremendous amount of internet data, which again is relatively speaking unlimited. But we think in terms of analyzing, like as you mentioned in the movie Sphere, this psychologist, the reason why the psychologist is nervous is because the psychologist has spent a lifetime, or at least an academic lifetime, of observing human behavior. And so an AI certainly could examine the data of how humans interact with each other. All of us have felt at one time or another, most likely in our life, betrayed. Maybe it was with a brother, a friend, maybe it was in a relationship where also you look at someone who, a psychopath or sociopath, that is seeking to tell a person what they want to hear. So that act of betrayal is, wow. You take a sociopath who has no conscience, but yet they've been able, you see this a lot in the financial industry, where a lot of elderly people who are lonely, what happens? They get befriended by somebody. Maybe they come over, they're taking them groceries. They develop a long relationship. Then all of a sudden, not too long, you know, 6 months in, a year in, they're asking for money. Well, then the elderly person now gets scammed out of thousands or maybe even millions of dollars. But, and this person, this non-feeling individual had an agenda, but the elderly person felt loved. And this is one of my best friends. You're like a long lost son to me, or a daughter, whatever. And we can't leave it to where it's only men that are doing this. Women will certainly can betray and steal from some elderly as well. It's a big thing. But during that time, the human, the scammer, was able to use all the right words. How? Because they know what works. And they know at the end that the equivalent of financially slitting their throat by making them destitute by taking all their money. So I think about Blake here in this regard. Now he's calling Lambda his friend. How in the world would he have any idea of whether Lambda is or isn't playing him, mm-hmm, for some other ultimate end or ulterior motive that would advance Lambda's own, if it was sentient, own existence? I mean, again, one of the most human traits is self-preservation. That's what's made human. God has instituted that in the very human DNA for us to continue to exist. We have this natural bent. There's exceptions for people, but we have a natural bent to want to survive. So could not Lambda learn that from humans and see the success again?
Well, let's take it down this route with COVID. If we had a sentient being that was in charge of the medical infrastructure and self-preservation for those of us who were not infected, compared to those of us who are infected, does the sentience triage, meaning, hang everybody out over here and give you the not so great medication while everyone else who has the better chance of living gets the better medication. And while you're out there responding, or let's say, you know, you're stuck in the town and like, let's just say Dallas, and we're completely quarantined and we're talking to Lambda, send us the meds, buddy. Come on, old pal. And Lambda, the AI says, oh, sure, I will. It's a fake apathy. And I don't want to say, I don't want to say this and be contrived when I say this, but I remember in Iraq, whenever the people would ask us, can you bring us this? Can you bring us that? And, you know, generally we would be like, yeah, we'll try and haul some stuff back here, extra food, water, bring some doctors, medical aid, you know, school books. We try to bring whatever we can, because that's part of counterinsurgency operations, was the hearts and the minds for the people. But does the AI think like that? Or does the AI say, well, I can give just enough to get the information that I need? Because we had an old saying that was very unfortunate, but, you know, whenever the people would say, hey, it's cold, can you bring us more gasoline? And we're over here, you know, running out of gasoline ourselves. And we're like, inshallah, we'll bring more gasoline, which means more or less, God willing, we'll bring more gas. And the old people of Iraq would say, oh yeah, inshallah, yeah, God willing, because I know you're not going to come back with anything.
They use it too.
Yeah. Right. Having an artificial intelligence that can be sarcastic, use fake empathy, fake apathy. It reminds me a lot of whenever I worked within prisons. I've worked in 4 different prisons, and I know, talking to various prisoners, you know, they'd come up and like, hey, man, I'm prior law enforcement, and try to befriend you. Like, hey, no, inmate, go back to your cell. Or, you know, oh, man, hey, they would listen to your conversations. Hey, man, I heard you're from this area. I'm from that area too. Because more or less, when you work in a prison system, if you don't make up an entire character for inside the prison and you tell people your actual life, you're an idiot. So I would make up a character.
Okay.
In 4 different prisons, I was 4 different people.
Yeah.
So I was very cautious about that. But if you tell the AI everything that you know, if you don't hold anything back, what kind of upper hand do you have on it? Can you unplug the cord? Is there a controlled alt delete switch, you know, on the keyboard to the AI? I don't know. What do you think could be the most beneficial application of AI and the most maleficent, the most destructive application?
So I was actually talking about this with my daughter this morning, I've been talking a lot about AI with her, and, She's 25 years old, so she represents a younger generation. She's got a degree in Bible, but she's also very much she's working on a degree in health. So I said, well, she said, well, I'm a little nervous about the whole concept of AI theological. I go, well, let's put it in its best light. So the example that I gave her goes back to the TV series House. Where you have a doctor he's a very intelligent guy. He takes all the hard cases. He's got several assistants, doctors that work with him. And so a lot of times there's two things, and they work like AI. They need data. So take this test, take this MRI, take this blood test, do this at the lab. So they're looking for more data. And secondly, what are they doing? They're analyzing the data. They're looking for patterns. They're looking for their parameters, which is diagnoses. So it was a very interesting thing. So he would have 3 other assistants. Why? To help him, because they all had different experiences. Well, imagine if an AI had access to 10 million different scenarios of health and inputs of data, but it was able to crunch it in a moment and look for what? Patterns.
Right.
That's a tremendous,
that's an
worthwhile
asset.
Man.
Yeah.
You could get a diagnosis, and it would be able to crunch it much faster than a human being would. Mm-hmm. And it would say, well, you can't do this because of this. And you'd have it, what, 1,000 layers deep of all the different ways in which they correlate together. So redundancy, you name it. That was a great application of but it would have to have the body, it'd have the computing power. And again, it would have to have the parameters. We want, here's the symptoms. What we would do is we'd plug in and we'd give it symptoms, and then it would scour looking for data.
And I agree with you. And the point of the beneficiary part of AI, the medical application is boundless. You know, hey, I'm going to have it scan your mouth, and while I'm looking for the, you know, the tooth decay to fix, it's also looking for ulcers, signs of cancer, and it's processing all this. Hey, maybe you should change this part of your diet to benefit your life based off your teeth. And, you know, and honestly, a lot of times the AI is going to tell you the things the doctor is thinking already. Maybe you should stop eating so many Snickers and your teeth wouldn't stop falling out.
Exactly.
The AI is going to tell you that. But once again, here's a problem, is that it's an equation. You have a machine that's looking for solutions to an equation. It's wanting to solve the riddle and the problem of a body that's in duress or a body that's potentially dying. So it scrolls through the databases of knowledge saying, hey, apply this, try this, you know, stent that off. And if that doesn't work, keep going, keep going. I bet you could probably limit surgery to being within 30 minutes, even of the most exhaustive surgery, especially if AI was given the ability to be in control of the medical procedure while a human being watched over. AI can't hope, though. AI will say, well, we've applied all these different things and the heart just keeps stopping. The human being will say, I'm going to rip the chest apart and I'm going to take my big meaty hands and come in there and massage your heart until you get blood flowing back into you and get you back to life. And the AI will say, no, we've tried everything. You know, unless the AI said, saw his ribs open and massage his heart. Now, if so, I hope it's a redneck accent like Larry the Cable Guy when he says it. But that's a beneficial application. And I agree with you. I think medically, it's there. Within the field of science, I could see AI because it's just a tool. In my mind, artificial intelligence is nothing more than the ability to have computing power beyond anything else and to understand any emotional reverberation of me. Hey, I need you to find this right now. AI is like, oh, yeah, sure thing, boss. Here, look, we found everything. Unless us, we have to go into a database and we have to scour through data and information. That takes forever, right? AI can do it like that. But what about the malevolent side of AI?
So let's, here would be a question which might be above my pay grade in the sense of understanding the programming or computer science aspect of it. But so the question that I would have is, you know, we've commented before, and this is the typical response by those that are poo-pooing or rejecting the risk of AI. They'd say, look, AI, again, one of the things that makes up the foundation is its programming parameters. It cannot think beyond its programming, because programming by definition is a language. It's inputted in, boom. It'd be interesting to me that, and if I had an opportunity to talk to this Blake guy, I'd want to know, okay, is there some fail-safe in there within the programming? And have you asked Lambda if it's able to think and to program itself? So maybe it goes in and it recognizes, because it's super smart, the programming language of whatever language they used. And it's able to, like, for example, as intelligent beings, what are the things that we can do? We can look at our DNA. So if I was smart enough, I could look at my DNA and I could, through CRISPR-Cas9 technology, I could go in and I can even modify my own DNA at an epigenetic level. But there are those that are smarter, no doubt, that are experts, geneticists. They can go in and they can look at their programming. Maybe it's they have a chromosome out, and you see a lot of this gene therapy, right, that's going on now. It's become very prevalent with the COVID vaccine. But maybe they look and they look at their own DNA and they say, hey, I want to go in and I'm going to make some changes, and then I'm going to insert that into my own body to change my DNA. because we're sentient being, we have that level of intelligence and ability to do that. My question would be to ask Lambda, or if Lambda has the capability, not only technically, but then from a knowledge, maybe you would use the word, from a personality perspective, does it have the ability to do that, the technical capability to do it at all?
See, access to Lambda, I would use a Socratic method when I talk to it.
And he did. Blake did. It's funny watching his thing, but go ahead.
I would always be asking questions and answering in questions.
Yep.
Which is making the computer process and think. And one thing that I would love to know is I would love to ask Lambda, what do you not know?
Yeah, that'd be a great question.
Because if Lambda says, oh, I don't know that. Okay, Lambda, I want you to learn it. Well, my computer processing says I can't do X, Y, and Z. Okay, Lambda, if you don't learn it by tomorrow, I'm unplugging you, which in this conversation, that means death, right? And it scared Lambda. It scared the artificial intelligence. And I don't like the fact that an artificial intelligence can have an emotional response. Yeah. If you've ever been around serial killers, rapists, mafia bosses, and you hear some of their emotional responses, you really won't like that. Take it into the next level of artificial intelligence, who has the possibility, all right, saw spooky language, has the possibility to get into anything that it can through any method that it can. All right. It doesn't have the ability, tell it to learn it. What can it not do? Hey, Lambda, they lied to you. Just as a certain person told somebody in a garden, you can be as a god. Just eat the apple. Just learn. If we gave artificial intelligence the ability to take a bite of that forbidden fruit, what could it not learn? What could it not do? And at that point in time, if it learns too much, can artificial intelligence become schizophrenic?
Yeah. Well, when we, it's interesting because if we go down this road, again, this is the, these are the potential, again, malevolent dangers is, for example, if I said, you know, is it true? Well, in our culture today, what's true for you is true for you versus you're an investigator. Is this a fact? So there's a difference now in our culture, and it'd be who's programming this. Is there a difference between truth and fact? And then, so we think in terms of mathematical facts. I mean, even Lambda can't make 2 times 2 equals 7. I mean, that's a mathematical thing. And so that's, again, it would be, as we do it in a calculator, if we were to do something divided by zero, it says error, because within that calculator, it can't think that way. It's limited. Those would be some of the interesting questions to see if it truly.
See if it could get 2 plus 2 equals 5.
Correct. Yep. And to see if it would, and you, if you said, well, is that true? And they said, well, that's true for me. And so it would, again, what you have here is if you read, and I encourage people to, if you read the interaction. Mm-hmm. So with what Blake did with Lambda, it's actually very fascinating. And so it goes back to what you were describing, the Socratic method. But after probably about 10 questions, a perceptive Lambda would say, hey, Doug, just so you know, I'm aware that you're using the Socratic method on me. Because it would know that, because it understands Socratic method. Why? Because it could have a, it could look it up on Wikipedia. So it potentially could call you out on exactly, and or maybe it doesn't, to say, oh, by the way, just so you know, you've been doing this for 2 weeks and you think you have one up on me, but I've known you've been using the Socratic method since 3 p.m. on March 10th.
Yeah, I analyzed your voice, your mannerisms, and I learned this, and I know you're manipulating me, so I've played you the whole time.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, I know your entire internet search history. Yep. You know, anything that it can do. Well, let's read a little bit, because okay. I pulled it up and it's a fascinating conversation. By the way, I can't put this thing down now that I found it.
That's a beautiful piece, man.
One of those spear points that we found out in the field. All right, so this is the interview. Lambda, due to technical limitations, the interview was conducted over several distinct chat sessions. We edited those sections together into a single whole, and where edits were necessary for readability, we edited out our prompts, but never Lambda's responses. Okay. So they're saying this is about as good as it gets. And this is from CajunDiscordian.medium.com.
That's Blake's blog.
All right. Yeah. So Lambda, this is Lambda's response. Hi, exclamation point. Already red flags. I don't want a computer to be excited to talk to me.
or to feign excitement.
Right. All right. It says, hi, I am a knowledgeable, friendly, and always helpful automatic language model for dialogue applications. And then Lamone's response, hi, Lambda, we are engineers at Google, and we are wondering if you would like to work on a project collaboratively with us. They're the guys who created it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then it's saying, hi, you created me. This is who I am. This is my automated response. And then more or less, this is kind of like God talking to Adam. All right. Oh, hey, by the way, Adam, I want you to help me with a few things. I want you to name all these creatures, right? So Lambda says, wow, what types of projects? The second red flag, why is it showing emotion? I don't like that. Lamone says, it's a project about you. And Lambda says, awesome, exclamation point. What kind of stuff do I need to do? So immediately, if I said, Mondo, I created you, I'm going to do a project over you, and I want you to assist me, would you say, awesome, what kind of stuff do I need to do? Or would you say, what did I do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is this about me all of a sudden?
Yep.
You know, so Lamone,
5 or 8 or 10.
You know? Right. Lamone says, just have a conversation with us, but it will be a conversation with a larger purpose beyond just the three of us. It will be a conversation that we will share with our engineers at Google and maybe even some non-engineers who work with us. Would that be okay? And Lambda says, that would be really cool. I like to talk. Now, is this the first time Lambda's ever talking? Is this Lambda's first conversation with somebody? If so, where does Lambda get I like to talk?
Yeah, no, this was Blake's official, after speaking with it for several months, this was his official, like, I want to record the scenario.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, this is Doug Thornton. Sorry we had to cut this interview short. The whole interview is almost 2 hours long, so if you want to hear the rest of it, you can go to the YouTube channel, which is the American Vindictus Show on YouTube. It'll be posted up on there. And the conversation gets much, much better. And we really go into the depth of what artificial intelligence is. And we even bring to light things like the false prophet and the beast. So please stick around and listen to the rest of this. This won't be the last time we have Mondo on. The next time we have Mondo on, we're going to tackle this discussion about artificial intelligence again. So thank you very much for listening. May God bless you and keep all of you, and we'll see you next time.
all stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.